information you can trust, stories you can relate to, and tips and tactics you can apply on your next adventure. Hunting, fishing, camping, and everything in between. This is the Battle Mountain Podcast. Hey everyone, thank you for tuning in to the show. Today we have Darren Christenberry on the podcast. Darren, thanks for hopping on the show again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
Yeah, well, I last time we chatted, we covered all sorts of stuff about archery, and we kind of discussed whether we should go in depth on some topics or not, and thankful for you, you were willing to do that. So on this podcast, I'd like to cover a couple things. One, I'd like to talk a little bit about the head-to-head bow test that I did, because obviously you helped me and supplied an Elite Omnia for that test. And so I would love to talk a little bit about that test and how the Elite performed. And then I'd like to dive into some of the aspects of the Elite itself, you know, the cams, the draw stop, the coating on the riser, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. And then I want to dive into arrows, because there's so many aspects of an arrow. But with that said, spoiler alert, if you can't get your arrow flying straight, it doesn't matter what you do to your arrow.
That's a fact.
So I guess we can kind of start there. Why don't you just kind of give just a little bit of a background on yourself, just, you know, real brief, and kind of maybe how your 2023 hunting season went.
Yeah, no, I work for the Outdoor Group in the archery industry, and the Outdoor Group is the parent company of Elite Archery, Scott Archery, Custom Bow Equipment, Winter Choice Bowstrings, Ultra Arrows now, golly, who am I missing? Slick Trick, Solid Broadheads, Dual Game Calls, Clutch Outdoors. It's just a huge business now in the archery space, and I've been shooting competitively since 1991 is when I started, basically when I was 21. I shot when I was a kid, but fell in love with archery as an adult and started chasing tournaments. Next thing you know, had a little bit of success on the tournament trail, got offered a job in the industry, and here I am 10 years late, going on 11 years now, working for the Outdoor Group, and passionate about this sport. I love shooting. Bow hunting, as I get older, is becoming less important to me. I know people are going to shame me for that, probably, or boo me for that, but I don't have anything against bow hunting at all. It just seems like everything else is more of a priority than me sitting in a tree stand thinking about what I could be getting done.
Yes.
And that's basically where I found myself for 2023's hunting season. I didn't hunt much. I actually feed the deer here at my house. I have just shy of 6 acres, and for the past 4 or 5 years, I have provided a home to some really nice bucks, but Indiana is a no bait state. So if you want to hunt the property you're feeding deer on, you have to pull the food and the feeder and wait at least 10 days. Well, I didn't want to do that. I was like, well, I'd rather watch the deer. So I send pictures to all my buddies of all these giant deer I've been growing. And I thought, well, this year I'll quit feeding in September. And that way, if these big bucks come through October, November, I'll hunt right here at home, you know, and reap the rewards of all this. And lo and behold, never saw the first buck, not one time this year. So I started feeding again. I took the food away. The girls, I guess, went away, and there was no need for the boys to come around. So they did not show themselves. I had a couple little dinks come in here in the past couple of weeks, but the big, nice deer that I'd been getting hundreds of pictures and videos of for the past 4 or 5 years that I had dreams of hunting legally, went down the drain pretty quickly. So that basically sums up my hunting season.
Okay. And what about your tournament season? How many, what kind of tournaments did you go to, and how'd that go for you?
Actually pretty good. I mean, for those that don't know, I've made it pretty public that I switched hands 2.5 years ago. Just struggled shooting as a righty and just, you know, couldn't get where I wanted to get something, a physical ailment that was keeping me from holding a bow steady. It looked like I, and I'm not making fun of it, it looked like I had Parkinson's disease when I was aiming. I shook really bad.
So gotcha.
It was either switch hands or quit. And I certainly wasn't ready to quit. So I took on the challenge of trying to become a competitive archer in 2023. 2022, I actually got a couple of podiums, but 2023, I only had one finish on the 3D ranges outside of the top 10. I did win the third leg of the Triple Crown, got second at the Iowa Worlds. I got second at two of the ASAs. And like I said, sixth place was about my normal finish other than my podium spot, but starting to see some success. I'm working like crazy trying to figure out this indoor game as a lefty, and it is an emotional roller coaster. I feel like I have everything figured out in practice, and I go to a tournament, and I'm like, well, that didn't work.
Right.
I just got back from South Dakota Monday. I'm heading to Iowa tomorrow probably for the Iowa Pro-Am. Then we got a weekend off while everybody's shooting in Nîmes, France, and then Lancaster, and then Vegas back-to-back. So tournament season is 23 is over and 24 is quickly on us.
Yeah. So when you say that didn't work, you know, are you trying out different releases? Are you trying out different, you know, stabilizers and things like that on your bow? Like what are you referring to when you say that didn't work?
Yeah, I guess, you know, there's a few people out there, you know, whether it's a type A, type B personality, I don't know which one's which. I'm no psychologist or expert on any of it, so don't get me wrong, I'm not an expert on anything I talk about, but I just, in the comfort of my home, I have a range at home. I built a 30 by 70 building 17 years ago, got a wood stove out there, 55 inch TV, all my 3D targets are in there. It's my man cave, but it's also my indoor range, and I spend an absurd amount of time out there working on things. And as I did this left-handed transition, I spend a lot of hours out there, and I see so much improvement day to day, week to week, month to month. And my scores in practice are really competitive, like really competitive. But as I've gone to the tournaments, they're like night and day. It's not even close to what I've been averaging in practice. That's a mental block. I truly believe that's a mental block. And point of my initial statement there was the type personalities. Some of these guys have got it figured out. They don't care if it's the first arrow for practice, the first arrow for score, the last arrow for a perfect round, the last arrow for a 30X, first arrow for 50 grand. They don't care. They can stand there and just shoot their bow like it's nothing. I have yet to master that. I've struggled with that my whole indoor career, trying to stay out of my own way. And what I mean by, you know, that didn't work was, I feel like everything I do at home and in practice is awesome. I can find a groove. I can get in a zone. I can shoot these nice competitive scores. And then when I get to the tournament, it's like, okay, let's try a little harder. And you don't have to try harder. You just got to relax and do what you do. You just got to shoot your shot and execute. And I think about the wrong things. I think about, oh, this is your first arrow for score. Oh, this is the last arrow of the half. Oh, this is the last arrow for... And I'm checking boxes as I go. I'm shooting my best rounds ever in a tournament. I'm shooting my highest scores ever in practice as a lefty. So I get a little amped up when I get close to reaching another goal as a left-handed archer now. So whether you call it I guess it could be called nervous. I get a little nervous when I start to check these boxes, and it's not giving me the results that I get in the comfort of my home range, and I'm making a small equipment adjustments. I'm working on my mindset, working on just some mental training things that I can do to try to bring those scores from practice to tournament closer together. Cause right now they are too far apart for my liking.
I gotcha. Yeah. I could totally see, and the same thing happens in hunting, you know, obviously you're out there, you're shooting 3D targets and you're just smashing them. And then something living comes out in front of you and everything all hell breaks loose.
That's right.
So I suppose that's part of that is why we do it. Right. The other side of that is learning how to control that so that we can still be successful while still having that feeling.
Yeah. And the things I'm trying to control is like when I'm at home practicing, I can get my heart rate up a little bit. Like I shoot a virtual league on Facebook with a whole bunch of people. We shoot $20 a person, 6-week league. We have to shoot a score, take a picture of it, submit a round each week. you know, and it's basically the honor system. But when you take a picture of your target, you can tell what kind of target you've shot. So, yep. And I've shot some amazing rounds. But then I go to a tournament. I went to the Hoosier 690. I went to Joe Capps Holiday Tournament up in South Bend, Indiana. Went to Yankton, South Dakota this past weekend. And Saturday, I shot my best indoor round at a tournament as a lefty. And then Sunday, I turned around and shot my worst Vegas round at a tournament this year. And I'm just like, okay, that's total opposites, just day to day. And what I noticed was as I got a little tense or put a little pressure on myself, my bow doesn't aim as good. And then when it doesn't aim as good, as I'm starting to execute, I'll just get a quick little abrupt movement, whether it be low right or high or low left. And that little movement with good tension between your bow hand and your release hand will fire the release. Just as soon as the bow moves, boom, it fires. And you're like, crap, that's not in the middle. And that's where I'm getting my misses. So I've come home and I've tried to distribute the weight better. I've played with holding weight. I've played with draw length. I've played with everything to try to get the bow to aim. If I'm pushing a little harder or if I'm trying a little harder, I'm trying to keep the bow at a nice steady float and eliminate that short abrupt movement that fires the release when I'm a little bit tight. So that's what I've been working on. And when I say, oh, that didn't work, everything works at the comfort of my own home. When I'm relaxed and practicing, I can make any setup work. When you're at the tournament and you get a little nervous, you're in your tree stand and a 200-inch deer walks by, can you handle it? Do you have the right mindset and the right setup to execute? That's what I'm fishing for.
Yep, absolutely. And you know as well as anyone that that takes time, patience, and consistent effort.
Yep, and that's I tell people all the time, they're just like, oh, I don't know how you're doing this left cast. I got a lot of try in there. I got a lot of try. I said, I may not ever get to the point I want to get to. I may not ever achieve all the goals I have in my head, but I sure got a lot of try. I shot till 1:15 this morning. I was outside working on arrows, changing knots, playing with stabilizer weights, playing with different lengths of stabilizers, stabilizer positions, adjusting my draw stops to increase my holding weight, playing with the lead. I mean, just constantly searching for this consistent sight picture where I can say, okay, I can work with that. And I'm trying to, I can't go to another tournament this weekend with the exact same setup that I just came home with from South Dakota and expect a different result. So I don't want to go drastic in my changes, but I have to change something to try to find a better consistency when I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that's the definition of insanity, you know, doing the same thing and expecting different results. Yep. But I really want to stress on what you just said there. You said you're making small changes. And I was very guilty of this. And now I've kind of I try my best to tone it back. But if you go in and you're making all these huge changes, all of a sudden your bow goes from being really close to being completely different because your changes were too much and too fast.
Yeah. And that's exactly what it was. And I was talking to Nathan Brooks earlier because he's like, well, what are you doing different? And I said, man, I went totally opposite. I had a 28 inch front bar on and a 12 inch back. I think I had 9 ounces on the front and I think 18 ounces on the back. I came home and put on a 30 and a 15, totally different bar, stiffer bar, and loaded up the weight. I had like 14 ounces on the front and like 28 ounces on the back, like really increased the weight to see if it would slow the bow down as I aimed a little longer or got a little more pressure between my hands to see if it would keep the bow from giving me a short, jerky movement. I got fatigued really quick. But as I got loosened up and shot the bow last night, it was a nice rhythm. Things were firing good. I was shooting a lot of middle. And I was like, okay, this works. Well, I went right out first thing this morning and thought, new day, I'm cold, let's go, aimed like crap. It was so opposite of what I was looking for. So instead of changing dramatically, I thought, okay, let's use the same weight variation I have been using, but just change the bars.
Right.
So I went to a little longer bars with the exact same weight configuration, and that seems to give the balance just a little bit more control. Now, again, I've shot, I'll say, 100 arrows today in between lunch and right after work and things like that, and I'll go shoot again this evening. But I'm just trying to narrow it down, find the most consistent float, give me a good, confident sight picture in practice that I think I can go to the tournament and see some results with. And that's what I do when I'm trying to you know, I went too big of a change. If you right. change strings and cables and change your arrows and change your release and change your broadhead, and all of a sudden your archery or your bow hunting setup goes to crap, where do you look?
Yeah.
You know, what changed? Everything changed. You don't yep. know what to look at. So that's what I was guilty of last night. I went to this massive weight, longer bars, and was like, ooh, this isn't good. Let's tone this back a little bit. So,
right.
I think I'm on the right track. So I feel like that. My mind says it's okay.
There you go.
And I get another chance to shoot, try it at a tournament this weekend to see if the Mad Professor gets anything right this time.
There, that, yeah, for sure. With like this morning, when you go, okay, cool, let's shoot this a couple times and let's see how it feels. How many shots do you give it before you go, nope, definitely not it. I need to make another change.
I like to get warm. I like to shoot at least 20 arrows before I ever say, okay, let's judge this shot. The
gotcha.
First arrow out of the bow, it's nice to go out there and have that thing lock up in the middle and you fire a Super X right out of the gate. That's awesome. And I'm looking for that consistency. You don't want to go out there and shoot them all over the target and say, okay, I got to get warmed up. The best shooters in the world don't have to have 20 or 30 shots to get warmed up. They're very close to the middle. And I'm getting older. I don't hold as good as I used to, but I need to warm up and loosen my muscles up, especially, you know, 7:30 in the mornings when I was out there this morning, getting the fire going good and just trying my first few arrows of the day. But I like to get about 15 or 20 shots in and say, okay, now let's see where I'm at for the day.
Okay. Well, that makes perfect sense. And this literally ties right into, you know, transitioning into talking about the head-to-head bow test that I did. And obviously, like I stated in the intro, I'm not, you know, if I just want to talk about me and what I did, I can do that on my own podcast. But the reason I want to discuss it a little bit on here with you is because of your relationship with Elite, and the role that you play there, as well as the role that you play to me in getting an Elite for me to test.
Yeah.
So first off, thank you for doing that. Cause my whole goal with the head-to-head test is for somebody to come, and watch that test and go, okay, here's the things that I want in a bow. Which one of these has that?
Yeah.
Because I would imagine you get this question a lot, because I do, and you're more in the archery world than I am. But people will go, well, which bow do you recommend?
Yeah.
And I always start by, well, which ones have you shot? You know, because
exactly.
You know, each one is going to shoot and feel different for each person. But like with this head-to-head test, what I did is I took, I had the Elite Omnia, the Matthews Phase 4, the Hoyt VTM 31, and then the Gearhead P30. And, okay. For this specific test last year, there was a PSE as well, but not this year. And so I put all the bows at, as far as speed goes, I put all the bows at a 27 inch draw, and I shot them all with the same arrow. And then I switched, on top of it, they all had the same rest, the same arrow rest. And then I moved it to 29 inch draw. And I shot them all through the chrono. On a side note, it's kind of funny. I had somebody comment on my post, the video. He's like, that bow looks way too long for you at 29 inches. And somebody else commented, yeah, he's just testing the arrow speed. So it was kind of funny. I guess people are paying attention, so that's a bonus.
Yeah, that's a good.
You know, and then what I did is I tested the sound that is emitted when you shoot the bow. So I have a decimal meter. Okay. I have the decimal meter the same height, and I put it very close to the same position, directly in line with the handle of each bow. And each one of these is a three shot. So three shots with the sound for each bow, three with 27 inch draw, three with 29 inch draw. And then I also measure the back wall. So I draw the bow back on a draw board. I take a tension release, and my tension release is set at 17 pounds. So when your bow is at, you know, when you're completely cammed over on your back wall and your draw stops are barely touching, most of them were right around that 8 pound mark, or very close. And what I would do is I would start pulling on that scale until it reached the break off of what my release would be. And I would measure the distance that would travel for your back wall and how solid that is.
Gotcha.
And then on top of that, I just did a small segment where I just discussed the draw cycle. Because obviously, yes, I can put a bow on a draw board and I can draw out a draw force curve. But the Elite is a case in point that the draw force curve may mathematically come out steeper than some of the bows it was tested against, but due to the design of that cam, and again, this is where I'm very interested to discuss this stuff with you. So I just want to discuss how I tested it, and then we can really get into the Elite and its performance. So anyways, and then I did shootability, and shootability to me is not how well a bow can shoot out of a Hooter shooter. Because in my mind, every bow should be able to shoot out of a mechanical Hooter shooter. Why wouldn't it?
Right.
In my mind, shootability is how forgiving is this bow to help remove my inconsistencies as an archer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I shot 3 arrows at 20, 40, 60, 80 for each bow. And then I field tested each bow and I hunted with them as well. So that was the overall head to head bow test. Part one covers all those tests together, and then part two is the field test.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I had shot several Elites before, but I've never owned one until this one that you sent. And I have to say, Darren, you guys are on the right track. That thing is, it's wicked.
Yeah, and the Omnia, you know, am I mistaken, or are you a lefty?
I am a lefty.
That's what I was thinking, and I know we had talked about getting you a Carbon Era, but the supply-demand of that was so out of balance after the launch, the only way we could get something to, I think, in a timely manner was an Omnia.
Yep.
But the Omnia is like, that was Elite speedbow. You know, so people that were new to the brand that maybe the Omnia was their first Elite may not be the true impression of what Elite actually is or what Elite Archery stands for. Shootability, Elite Archery coined that term. And again, like you, it's not how accurate is it in a shooting machine. Shootability is how shooter friendly is this bow? How easy does this mask the human error? How shooter friendly is it? What's the draw cycle like? Does it hurt me when I fire this thing? Does it vibrate like crazy? Does it make my teeth clatter? No. Elites never chase speed. Shootability has always been the motto. And we've had some faster bows. We've got, you know, a mod system now on the new bows where you can get a smooth performance or 75%. And the Omnia, I BO'd it. It's 6-inch brace height. With the performance mod, you know, and 347 foot a second, we typically don't put that kind of bow to the market.
Right.
Speed typically relates to shorter brace heights. Shorter brace heights typically result in a more critical exposing your flaws in your form and your shooting. And
100%.
We don't want people to have a bad experience. So we make smooth draw cycles. We make bows that have less vibration, that are shooter friendly, that are hopefully easy to tune for people. And that's what shootability means to us.
Yep.
You know, we want a great experience when you're shooting your bow.
100%.
And this year's bow Ethos is probably one of the finer. You hear people talk about Elite Archery. They say the Energy 35 or the Synergy or their Answer. There are some flagship bows that we've built over the years that really people, I'm never going to get rid of it. I get that. It's their best friend. They're comfortable with it. I totally understand that. But with technology and the different mods that you can put on our cams now, our newer stuff, in my opinion, is the best stuff we've ever had to offer.
Jeez. Well, to address some of the stuff you just said, so for anyone that listens to this podcast, I've been fortunate that I've been able to test a lot of different bows and a lot of coined speed bows. And I can tell you firsthand that the Omnia is without a doubt the smoothest drawing, most shootable speed bow I have ever shot.
Yeah.
And I genuinely mean that. It was anywhere from 25 feet per second to, it was 25 to 50. The next closest bow was 10 or 15 feet per second slower. And the draw cycle was, I mean, you know as well as I do, between having a shorter brace height and having a really hard either transition or dump into that back wall because that cam has to store all that energy, that's where you start drawing and all of a sudden you're just, oh gosh dang, you hit that back wall and your bow jiggles all over hell and it's like, what just happened?
Yeah.
That's that cam trying to store that energy. And
yeah,
I was just super impressed with the bow itself, but man, the overall shape of the cam itself and that draw cycle, and it's like there's a slight transition into it, but nothing like any other coined speed bow I've ever shot. I mean, it was just a pleasure to draw and shoot.
Yeah, and that comes standard with the performance mod, and the same with our Ethos, our newer bow this year. If you didn't like the draw cycle, it's amazing what the smooth mod does. And you'll lose a few feet per second. I'm talking 5 to 7 feet per second on an apples-to-apples draw length. So if you're shooting the bow at a 30-inch draw with performance and you bolt on a set of smooth mods at 30-inch, you're probably going to lose 5 to 7 feet per second. So it does affect your performance a little. But a lot of people are willing to sacrifice a few feet per second for the comfort it gives you in that draw cycle. It builds and it stacks a little bit, but it rolls over into the valley a lot softer than an abrupt dump.
Exactly.
That you're talking about. So, you know, when people purchase a bow, they have options, you know, and people are like, well, I don't like it. Well, try a different set of mods for $50 or whatever.
Right.
You know, whatever you can get them through your dealer for. And it really, truly is like 2 or 3 different bows. Every set of mods makes that bow feel different. Then you have quarter inch draw length adjustments. You have micro adjustable holding weight. You can do limb stops. You can do cable stops. I feel like we check a lot of boxes when it comes to offering a good bow to a big audience. I feel like we have a great offering.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, again, what you mentioned with when you're getting that kind of speed, typically the actual shootability / consistency that you can shoot this bow goes way down. And for me, I was just blown away. And I just pulled up the test just so I could give the actual numbers of the arrow group sizes that I shot. Cause I don't want to misquote cause Lord knows they'll eat me alive. So at 20 yards, I shot a 1-inch group. At 40 yards, I shot a 1.08-inch group. At 60 yards, I shot a 1.895-inch group.
Wow.
And at 80 yards, I shot a 3.083-inch group.
Nothing wrong with that.
No. And on top of it being that fast, it was just, if this, and I have to be careful what I say here, right? Because obviously I test other companies' bows too. you know, but what I would say is if I didn't have to test other bows on hunts, I would have taken it on every single hunt.
Nice.
You know,
nice.
That's how impressed I was with it, Darren. I mean, you guys are just, you just crushed it with it.
That's great feedback. I mean, that's what we're looking for. And, you know, I'm open-minded when it comes to this industry, and I don't look down my nose at people because they're brand loyal. I'm a Dodge guy. I'm not saying I wouldn't drive a Ford or a Chevy or something different, but if I'm going to shop for a new truck, Dodge is what I look for first. That's just my preference. And
yeah.
I know people are Matthews guys. I know people are Hoyt guys. I understand all that, and I appreciate that. we are not trying to be number one. I still feel like we're one of the best kept secrets in the industry. You know, people are like, Elite, who makes Elite? They don't realize that Elite's a standalone brand.
Right.
You know, and Matthews has created this marketing machine. And I guess I'm not jealous of them. I'm envious of them. They've got such a good thing going. Hoyt has the international target market, just a stranglehold on that. They are known for making some of the most accurate bows in the world. And you see the scores that their shooters shoot with them. So, you know, is PSE and Bowtech and Elite and everybody else fighting for number three? Maybe, but we're good with that, because if we were bigger than what we are right now, I don't know how we'd meet demand. I don't know how we'd not have 4 and 5 month lead times, which is definitely not what you want for your customer base. You want to deliver stuff in a reasonable amount of time, and I think we're in a good spot right now. We're coming up with good innovations. We've got good offerings from entry-level bows to youth bows to mid-range stuff to flagship, now to carbon to fast. We just got a really good offering. So my sales pitch for everybody is, if you haven't tried one, just go try it. You may not buy it. You don't have to buy it. I'm not saying it is the best bow out there for you, but it's at least worth taking a look at.
Yes, 100%. With the Omnia itself, you'll have to give me the correct terminology, but the coating that is on the riser itself, mm-hmm. and in the grip, I don't know the correct term, but what I do know is it almost feels soft to the touch and kind of warm. Crazy. And so I don't know what exactly, if it's just a normal paint coat, I don't know what you guys put on your risers, but it was awesome in the hand.
We have a couple of processes that we use on all the aluminum stuff. If you have a camouflage bow, your bow starts out as a white bow. They take the raw aluminum after it's tumbled, treated, cleaned, and ready to, they call it a rhino dyes, is what the term that we coined a few years ago. It's a powder application that's baked on in an oven, so it's very durable. But anything that is camo, it's actually powdered white. It has a white base, and then we use what we call color fusion. It's basically socks. It's a long sleeve that goes over the riser, and then they put that in a vacuum sealed plastic bag. And they actually have a person that, and it's the most talented people in the factory, I'm telling you. They have to sit there and poke and press and pull and get this sock lined up with every curve, every cutout, every angle on that riser to where you get a nice fit. And when they get that exactly like they want it, they suck all the air out of that. And then that bag, sock, and riser goes into an oven, and it basically tattoos the ink from the sock into the white coating on the riser, and that's the color fusion. It fuses that color into that white coating on the riser. So that's how we get our camo patterns. That's why they're so bright and so clean and so crisp looking, is because we don't film dip. It's an actual heat process on powder, and it tattoos the design into the white coating. But then the flat colors, the OD colors, the black, the target colors, it's another powder process that are baked on. The bronze has a clear coat on it to make it really shiny. The new midnight copper this year is literally liquid bronze without the clear coat. But it's some sort of a magnetic thing. They powdered, if you've seen powder coat, it's the same sort of process, but they throw this stuff in an oven and bake it on, and it creates a nice shell, a nice protective coating on your riser. But it is our fit and finish, I think, is as good as anybody's in the industry, especially our camouflage stuff. It looks really, really nice. We don't cut any corners. Like I said, the people that do that color fusion are some of the most talented people in the factory. To get that stuff done, you can't just hire somebody off the street and say, hey, make that work. It takes some time to figure that out. But yeah, we do, like I said, I don't think we cut any corners. We put a nice product out the door to the customer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just impressed because, you know, obviously the bonus of a head-to-head test is I grab a bow, I take 3 shots, and I grab the next bow. So I am immediately getting to feel the difference, feel the paint finish, feel if it's cold to the touch or if it's warm to the touch, if it's rough or if it's smooth. Like, I get to feel that immediately. Sure. And there's certain bows that, I don't like, for example, like the grip that comes with them. So I take the grip off. Almost before I even shoot the bow, I just take it off, and then I shoot the bow way better. But yeah, that paint touch, that paint finish that y'all have is just, it's awesome. As far as the cam is concerned, I guess due to it being such a smooth draw cycle and it's still having, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Omnia has a 6-inch brace height.
Yes.
How is it so fast?
One of the biggest things we started to target years ago was the efficiency of a bow. And what that meant was, if you're drawing 70 pounds and you're putting 70 pounds of energy, how much of that energy is the arrow? How much is being stored in the arrow? How much energy is wasted? And that means, vibration. That means, all this dissipating energy. And we were creating some very, very, very efficient bows. I'm not an engineer, so I can't speak super intelligently about it, but the limb deflections, the way they cut this stuff, the parallel limbs, the designs of the cams are way bigger now than they used to be in years past. It's just, I don't know how they do it, because 10 years ago, I said at every league night and every archery shop and every tournament going, okay, they've finally done it. They've hit the ceiling. The bows can't get any better.
Right.
And every year, somebody comes out with something bigger and better and greater and new and faster and more efficient. It's really silly. So, I don't know how they continue to do it. And, I guess that's why we pay the engineers the big bucks. It's their job to find avenues to squeeze more out of one. And,
yeah.
And like I said, I don't know exactly why, especially with the big cams, and the different mods and stuff, rotating mod, different things, draw length specific cams may be a little bit more efficient from draw length to draw length versus a rotating mod, but still we've got it down to where, I mean, these things are super fast. Even at generous brace heights of 7 inches, you're still getting 340 foot a second out of a lot of this,
which is nuts. So
it is. It's crazy. That's shooter friendly too. That's the big thing. Years ago when Pearson came out with a spoiler and it was shooting 300 foot a second, it wasn't an easy controllable machine to shoot.
Right.
Now 330 feet per second is like a piece of cake. Right. It's manageable.
Yep.
So technology, we talked about technology at the beginning of the podcast, and technology's brought the archery industry to new levels, and we haven't seen it peak yet, and it's crazy.
Yep, it is 100% crazy. What would be cool, Darren, is in the future, if especially if two things would be awesome. If we get another bow lined out that gets sent for this 2024 head-to-head test, it would be awesome to have that bow sitting on the desk in front of me, and we literally walk through the aspects this bow has to offer, from switching mods to let off to the angle of the cable guard to all of it. It would be really interesting to discuss all that and then go over, well, when you change the angle of the cable guard, what is that even doing?
Yeah. And there's so much that you can dive into, and I know the majority of bow hunters rely on their archery shop and their technician at their local shop to do their, and I appreciate that. We don't ever want to, circumvent our dealer base. We need them. I mean, we appreciate them, but for the guy that has the equipment at home, that has the ability and the knowledge to work on his equipment, man, we've got something so shooter friendly.
Yeah.
And you can dive into it more if you want to shim the cams to utilize the set technology, and the set technology is the limb pivot, where you can you know, change the attitude of the cam to help your tuning and your broadhead flight. You know, if you get far to one side, you can change the spacing of your cams to get your cam back toward the middle. So there's just so much in-depth stuff that you can do, not only to our bows, to every bow out there. Matthew's got the top hat system. Bowtech's got the deadlock system. There's so much technology out there that's right at your fingertips that people pay for,
yep,
that they don't really utilize because they're like, hey, my guy at the shop did this for me and I'm ready to go. Yeah, but you could do so much more with just little tweaks here and there you can improve so much. So I guess advice to people is if you're spending $1,200 or $1,300 on a flagship bow, utilize the technology that our engineers have put into those things and make yourself the best shooting machine you can make yourself because it's right there at your fingertips.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Well, now that's kind of a great transition. You know, we're talking about speeds and arrows and all that kind of stuff. And as mm-hmm. promised at the beginning of the show, I truly want to dive into arrows. Because what I just did is, so I used to really love the Easton carbon injection 4mm. It was, I liked that it was 11 grains per inch. I liked that it was very heavy walled. I don't know that I ever had one break.
right.
I mean, it's crazy. And I shot this deer at like 70 something yards quartering to me and it went all the way. It hit him. It like clipped the scapula, went all the way through, hit the femur. He ran over, rolled down a hill over the arrow on top of it and everything. And it was still not broke.
Wow.
I mean, it's just crazy. They stopped making them. Right. So I have, one, I didn't know that you guys started offering arrows and had that, affiliation or else I would have reached out to you and discussed more before I bought some arrows. cause I'm not a, it's, there is certain things where I'm like, hey, this is what I'm shooting for sure. You know, but when it comes to arrows, I just want to shoot what makes the most sense. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I ordered six of the Victory, VAP SS's. So okay. that's a micro, you know, 4mm. I ordered six of the Easton Axis 4mm. And then I ordered six of the Easton FMJ 4mm.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had, the last 2 years I've been shooting the Easton Axis 5mm arrows. So I have six of those as well. And,
gotcha.
And obviously you know much, much more about arrows than I do. But my whole curiosity is stemming from, I used to shoot the FMJs and they were great. The only issue I had with them is like one time I was walking, I had my bow in my backpack and I got stuck on a tree branch and it bent all of my arrows. Cause obviously they have that aluminum shell. And
sure.
I thought, well, I don't know if I want to shoot those anymore, but those arrows shot incredible for me. And so I was like, okay, now what am I going to do? And then I shot the injections. They stopped making them. But my whole thought is I'm very curious and I'm wondering too, if you've done many tests with this, like the 5mm, I'm wondering what percentage you get as far as penetration by shooting a 4mm instead of a 5. I'm wondering how much less wind deflection you get by shooting a 4mm instead of a 5. You know, and fortunate I'm going to, my plan is I have some ballistics gel and things like that. And I'm going to have the arrows very, very close, you know, within like 5 to 10 grains.
Sure.
And I'm going to shoot them into ballistic shell because, yeah, I'm curious about that type of in depth of stuff because, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, no, and I think that's important, and it's also probably important depending on what region you're from too. I mean, you're in Wyoming, correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so it's nothing for you to see a 70 or 80 yard shot. I mean, that's a realistic shot where
yep.
you're at. Where I'm at, you know, I live in South Central Indiana. I hunt, you know, cornfields, bean fields, draws, just thickets. And if I get a shot over 40 yards, that's probably going to be my max on a lot of my set. So I don't have to be as, you know, I don't have to worry about the, you know, how much wind drift am I going to get? How much penetration am I going to get? I'm shooting at a, you know, a basketball size kill zone. So, you know, 80 yard shot's a lot different than a 30 yard shot.
Right.
You know, 4 millimeters in the wind's a lot different than a 2.46 at 20 yards. It's just apples to oranges comparison. So I think some of that information would be really good if you apply it to what region you're in. I don't need a 4 millimeter with small veins thinking I'm going to take an 80 yard shot. That's probably not going to happen where I hunt. But if I go to Wyoming hunting pronghorn in September, whew, you better have something that gets on down the road because those dudes are fast.
Yeah.
I do know that. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, I think it would be interesting to see, you know, just so people can educate themselves. Okay, I'm going to be hunting XYZ in this state, this state, this state. This might be the best arrow for me.
Yeah.
And you may have more than one hunting arrow. You may need to have more than one arrow set up depending on what animal you're hunting for one and then what state and what your environment's going to be like as well.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the truth. Like it's no different than, you know, going and shooting a feed around and shooting at Vegas.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
So I guess, you know, with now that you know a little bit about the things that I'm looking to test and everything like that, I would really like to just kind of cover your arrow building process. You know, I pulled up your Instagram. And the first picture you got is the SK2 fletchings on your new ASA build. And
Yeah. And
so that immediately I'm like, okay, great. This is literally what interests me, right? So here you have these arrow shafts.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to ask a bunch of questions, and then maybe as you're addressing your how you build your arrows, you can kind of address my questions.
Sure.
So essentially, you have a typically like a 31-inch arrow, and I need, I don't know, 28-inch arrow. So Are you cutting pieces off of each end? Are you then squaring both ends? Are you shooting more often? Are you shooting like a hot melt inserts and then like pin knocks, or is it more important to square the knock end as opposed to the point end? And then when it comes time for fletching, are you fletching up several different fletching variations, or have you done it enough that you know what you kind of need now? You know, those are kind of some of the questions that rattle around in my brain when I think of building arrows.
Yeah, no, I basically, it doesn't matter what application, whether it's indoors, 3D, feta, redding, hunting, doesn't matter. I basically do everything the same. I'll take, if I'm building arrows, I'm typically going to try to build 24 at a time.
Okay.
And you know, maybe they're from the same batch, maybe they're not from the same batch, but I will take every single arrow out. I have like I'm kind of OCD when it comes to stuff, and in your logo or your label on the arrow, whether it be an Easton Super Dry,
you need them in the same spot.
They need to be in the same spot. It drives me absolutely bonkers to have, you know, 2 inches higher. It just drives me crazy. So what I do, I take every single arrow shaft out and I spin it on a spin tester. I've got a Pine Ridge spin tester. I have the Last Chance Archery Arrow Building Center that has the squaring devices and the, you know, the straightener and the broadhead aligner. It's got all these neat little gadgets on there for you to build the best arrow that you can absolutely build. I've got, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 Bitzenberger fletching jigs that I can do 4 millimeter bushings. I can do unibushings. I can do pin knocks, and I have every single size of fletching from Flex Fletch that they make, multiple colors, multiple sizes, because, you know, I shoot all this different stuff. You know, redding needs a 1.87 or a 2.5 shield cut. You know, hunting may be the 3-inch Silent Night, or I may do 4 SK2s. Indoors could be the 360 or the 418. Just there's a different application for everything
right.
that I do, but when it comes to building them, I take every arrow out and I spin it on a spinner. I want to see if there's any wobble on either end and how much wobble I think there is. So, and I'll kind of grade them.
So, you know, quick question about the looking at the wobble. I don't mean to cut you off, but I know when I spin an arrow, sometimes I really struggle to see the wobble.
That's a good thing.
So, well, even, and then sometimes I'll spin it and someone will be like, yeah, look, it's wobbling. And I'm like, what?
You know the best way to test that?
That's what I was going to ask you.
take, if you have an arrow, even if you just are building hunting arrows and you have inserts with field points, and as long as you have a good quality field point, they're making field points on a machine and kicking them out as fast as they can. Some of them not be perfectly concentric, but if you're building target arrows for 3D or indoors and you're using competition archery points or, you know, whatever brand point, even the Easton's points, Ultra's points, you know, Gold Tips points, their components are really, really good. Everybody's are. Take your shaft and put a point. Don't glue it in. Just press a point in both ends of your arrow.
Okay.
And then put it on the spinner and test it. Because the point comes down to a perfect concentric point, or should. If your arrow's wobbling at all, it's very easy to detect when you have points in both ends.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, it's really easy to see. Really, really easy to
see.
So, and then you can grade them. You know, you can like, okay, this one I can't detect any movement at all. So it's an A, you know, and then you spin one, you're like, you know what? I think it might have just a little bit. It's a B, you know. So then I get, say I got like 9 A's, 2 B's, and 1 C. And the C meaning, ooh, it's probably got some wobble, so I may need to cut a half inch or an inch and a half off. So what I'll do, I'll take my worst arrow and I'll cut off the end of it, the knock end of it, until I get it perfect. And hopefully it's not much of a trim. If it's 1 or 2 inches, so be it. And then I'll cut my B arrows down 2 inches off and check the spin. Well, I know my A's are going to be good because they were really good at full length. If I'm cutting 2 inches off, then I know they're going to be spot on. So that's, I'm trying to get 12 of the best arrows that I can get out of that dozen. And, you know, not every arrow is perfect in a package. No manufacturer makes them absolutely perfect every single time. Are they all within 1,000? Hopefully. Are they all within 3,000? Hopefully. You may get one that spins 0.05, 0.06. It happens. But if you cut a half inch or an inch off that end, it may spin back at 0.001 again. There's run out in the manufacturing processes, and they measure stuff. Basically, your straightness is measured in the middle. I'm worried more about the knock-in than I am anything, because that's the point of contact to my string. That's what's launching my arrow with my broadhead or whatever. You can work on the broadhead to fix some wobble later in the build, but I'm worried about my knock-in first. So I basically grade them all, try to figure out what I'm going to have to cut off to get all my labels matching. And if I end up getting one arrow that just won't play with the rest, I just discard it. Don't try to make it a practice arrow. If it won't play with the others or it won't build up, just cut your losses. You know,
yeah.
You'll just drive yourself crazy. You'll drive yourself crazy trying to make that full dozen arrows work. I'd rather have 11 perfect ones as to have 12. Oh, I think I got the
well,
right
and mess with your confidence as well.
Sure.
Yep.
Sure. But, once I do that, I square everything. I clean everything with acetone and a Q-tip. That way, when I'm gluing in components, I have a nice, clean surface. I'll even wipe off my components before I glue them in. I typically, all my knock stuff, all my bushings or my pin bushings, I glue in with the boning blue glue, the low temp hot melt.
Okay.
It's basically like candle wax. You don't have to get a lot of heat. On aluminum, it's probably not as crucial. I still treat it very gingerly, I guess you would say, but I go low temp on my unibushings, and as soon as I get it on the component, I heat it up and I spin it as I put it in the shaft, and as soon as I get it seated, I go straight to cold water. I dip my end of my arrow with the hot component, whatever, straight into cold water, and I let it set for a second. It'll help that glue set up. It makes it easier to get off the shaft when you're peeling that stuff off. And I don't like to let that heat of the components dissipate through the carbon. The carbon is a blend of carbon fibers and resins, and whatever the manufacturing process is. And heat is not a good thing with carbon. It's just not good. So obviously, if you're using hot melt, it's fine. It will work. But I go straight to cold water to not let that heat dissipate through the carbon. Keeps it from warping, it ensures that I've still got good straight stuff by the time I'm done. And then I use a Saunders, it's another low temp hot melt, but it's real tacky. It doesn't take a lot of heat to make it soft, pliable.
Okay.
And I do the same thing. You know, I heat the component, I put enough glue to get a good seat on there. I then heat the component with the glue on it, spin it as I'm putting it in the shaft. And as soon as I get it seated, I go straight to cold water again. and that's how I put in all my components. I don't like to use a cyanacrylate glue because it's like permanent.
Gotcha.
And if you tear up a fletching, if you ding an insert, you can't get that stuff out. And if you heat the component up enough to get it out, the chances of you ruining the shaft or damaging the carbon go way, way up. So I use low temp hot melt. It's easy to get stuff in. It's easy to get stuff out. If you end up getting a wobbly insert or a bad point or a bad bushing or a bad knock fit or a bad pin, it doesn't take a lot of heat to get those components back out, and I never risk tearing up my arrow shafts that way.
I got you. Have you ever tested that low temp hot melt when, like, pulling broadheads out of a target?
I have not on broadheads.
Okay.
No, I've done it on target points a lot, and it works pretty good.
Gotcha.
It really does. But a big old fixed blade head in an aggressive target, I don't know. I can't speak on that.
Okay.
I don't know if that would work well or not.
Makes sense. So with your arrow building process, what would you say is the most crucial aspect of the overall arrow design? Is it squaring the ends? Is it making sure that all the arrows are spined the same way? Is it making sure that your overall arrow weight is as close to each other as possible? Like, what would you say is like one of the biggest aspects? I mean, obviously they all work together. I understand that. But if you had to pick one that was more important than the others, what would it be?
I don't know. I think I would give them all the same grade, to be honest. I want straight shafts. I want good square ends. I want nice component fitment. I want, you know, clean. I want a clean surface when I'm fletching. I want my vanes to be exactly 120 degrees apart if I'm doing three fletch. I want them to be exactly 90 degrees if I'm doing four fletch. I don't want a bunch of god awful glue squeezing out from under my vanes. I'm real picky about how I fletch them. I mean, that's the projectile that you're launching down range to, you know, win $20,000 or shoot the biggest buck of your life.
Right.
I take pride in building my arrows. I make sure they're neat. I make sure they're clean. I make sure they're accurate. I make sure they're straight. I make sure they're perfect. And I don't cut corners. So I guess, you know, making sure things are square, making sure your knock fits good, and not necessarily just knocking your component, but your knock fitment on your string, the serving
right.
size of your bowstring has to be right. And, you know, making sure your broadheads are spinning, your spine alignment, if you've got arrows that you can detect the high side of a spine or they need to be knock tuned, don't skip any of those steps. Because if you miss one step along the way, you've failed yourself at being the best you can be, or you've decreased your percentage of success. Your odds go down if you skip any of those steps, I guess. So I like to do a nice, clean, neat fletching job. I want to make sure my vanes are perfectly lined up. I want to make sure my broadheads are spinning straight. And then that all goes to how well can I tune my bow. You know, if you've got the best arrows in the planet and you're terrible at tuning a bow, doesn't matter how good your arrows are, you know. So and vice versa.
Yep.
You've got the greatest tuned bow in the world and you build crappy arrows, your success ratio goes way down. So
yep.
Everything's important, from fletching to, you know, taking care of your equipment to making sure you're maintaining your releases. If you hunt in the rain for 2 weeks straight and then throw your release in your backpack and don't get it out till next season, guess what? You've really increased your odds of having a failure of some sort. You got to take care of that stuff. So
right.
I think every step along the way is important. I can't really grade one thing over another because it's all ingredients to a perfect recipe.
Yeah, 100%. Well, you know, Darren, now that we've covered, you know, kind of your arrow building process, what I would love to have you back on the podcast and really dive into some of the smaller details that you mentioned when you were talking about that. So like the knock fit on your serving.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that is so, so important, but gets missed all the time. And sometimes, myself included, I have a set of knocks and so many sizes of serving or one size of serving and none of them fit the way that I know they should, but I'm also like, well, what am I going to do? Not just not shoot, you know? So, discussing some of the really fine details like that with you on another podcast would be absolutely awesome. But in the meantime, I thank you so much for coming on the show tonight and talking not only a little bit about your season and the consistency and helping and changing into being as consistent as you can as a left-handed archer, but then discussing, you know, the elite's performance in that test, and kind of some of the reasons why, and then your arrow building process. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, no, I love to talk archery. I mean, it's what I'm most passionate about. It's my life. It's my job. It's my hobby. So we could talk for hours and just deep. I said it before, I'm not an expert on all this stuff. I dabble with a little bit of everything. I feel like I even said this weekend we were talking about, I said, I feel like I shot a lot better when I was a lot dumber, you know, when I wasn't as smart about stuff and when I didn't try to make things better. I just said, okay, here's me, here's my bow. Let's go see how consistent I can be.
Right.
Now I try to make sure, every detail's right. And I'm like, am I really doing the right thing? So yeah, keeping it simple is sometimes a very quick road to success, and sometimes you can overthink stuff. But like I said, I'm not an expert on everything. I dabble with a lot of stuff. I'm interested in the game, and I love to hear people's opinions on stuff. I love talking to Tim Gillingham. Gillingham's he's been with Gold Tip forever. He's just he's a wealth of knowledge, and I like talking tech with guys that understand, because I don't understand everything. I don't know everything.
Right.
I don't know why. I don't know the cause and effect of every single thing. So I feel like I can learn something off of a lot of people as well. So,
absolutely. And that's why that's why I enjoy having people like yourself on the podcast, because I'm like, great, I'm going to ask so many questions.
Yeah. And I learn stuff too from people. You know, I love listening to people talk about archery and you know, your bow test that you found and, you know, why one bow shot better than the other. Can you figure out why it did? No, it just feels better. Okay, why did it feel? I mean, there's just so many avenues and so many rabbit holes you can go down with anything. Arrow building, broadhead flight, you know, fixed blade versus, I mean, golly, we could talk for hours.
Yeah.
You know, so, but yeah, no, I appreciate you having me on here. I'm glad to talk about archery and, you know, hopefully somebody learned something. And it's such a great sport, such a great thing to be a part of, and it's my passion in my life, so it's easy to talk about.
Yeah, and if anybody wants to follow along with Darren on Instagram, I will put his Instagram handle in the show notes of this episode, so you guys can check out all his posts and everything like that.
Perfect.